This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. At the beginning of the year, VPR's outdoor radio went on a tracking expedition with conservation biologist Steve Fascio.
Fun thing about following fisher tracks is they don't stalk their prey. They know their territory, they know their home ranges really well, and they basically are just moving through the woods sort of back and forth in sort of a non-random fashion, investigating places that they might flush prey out of, like places where there's dense brush. They're an animal of forest habitats, and they need fairly large blocks of forest, and they're primarily nocturnal, so they're mostly moving around at night, especially when it first gets dark, late afternoon, or the early part of the morning is their most active periods. Dawn and dusk. This is him right here. Jumped right over there. It looks like there's a little bit of a tail drag right there. I mean, look at the way it goes down this hill. That's not how a fox would go down a hill.
Obviously not how a fox would go down a hill. Don't be silly. That's Steve Fascio of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies tracking a fisher in the snow on VPR's outdoor radio. You can find outdoor radio online or you can get it as a podcast. Fabulous show. Now, you may never have seen a fisher in the flesh, but at this time of year, you have a decent chance of seeing one's tracks or seeing the sign of deer being chased by coyotes or finding the spot where an owl swooped down and snatched a mouse off the snow, leaving the impression of its wingtips as a calling card. Winter's snow means great opportunities for tracking wildlife, and we're going to spend some time talking about how and where to do it today with author, forester, and environmental educator Lynn Levine. Welcome, Lynn. Nice to have you back.
It's so great to be with you.
And with Rose Paul, the Director of Critical Lands and Conservation Science for the Nature Conservancy in Vermont. Hi, Rose. Nice to have you here, too.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be here.
So, Lynn and Rose, I'm going to put you both on the spot, but since we're talking about tracking, I hope this is something you can answer. I want to know the coolest thing you've seen out on the snow in terms of tracking. And Lynn, I'll start with you.
Well, this is a very strange story. It actually happens in the trees. What I was told from a landowner was to go out and check out an area where they thought the son-in-law had done some tricks. And in the trees, not in the tracks, in the trees were these pieces of apples just cut off, hiding high up in the crouch, in the on the ground, all over the place. And they were saying, "What happened?" And then I looked closer and I saw the bites inside, outside the apple, and I knew something was not the son-in-law.
What was it?
So I looked, I took a bite myself just to make sure it wasn't a human. And then I went home and I took the piece of apple and I happened to have a skull of different skulls. And I looked and it fit the bites of the red squirrel.
Huh.
That hides in its apples. It's very unusual, though.
Well, yeah.
It hides its food.
And probably very unusual for a person to have a bunch of animal skulls at home that they can go use to try to match to the bites in the apple.
Well, you should see my scat collection, too.
Yes. Dinner parties at your house are probably very entertaining, Lynn.
It's true.
Rose, what about for you? Coolest thing you've ever seen while tracking?
Well, Jane, there's something I see over and over again, and it always gives me just this moment of happiness. I love to see otter slides in the snow, and you can see them along streams where they're sort of going up and down into the water, then up onto boulders, and they're sliding along. But you can see them kind of crossing from stream to stream just in the woods, and I get this sense that they're having just as much fun playing in the snow as I do.
You know, it's ironic. I've actually seen several videos posted on Facebook and other places lately that are showing otters sliding in the snow. For some reason, it seems to be the thing that people are looking at right now. And it does look like they're having fun. They just look like they run and glide and run and glide and are doing this, it would appear, both for mobility, but also just for the sheer joy of it.
And it's true that not only the otters, but actually fishers sometimes do that too.
Huh. We actually got a note from Susan who says, several years ago, my partner and I were snowshoeing at Shelburne Farms after a big snow. We found a set of tiny tracks, maybe a mouse. The tracks came out of a little hole, tracked a ways across the snow and out from the trees into a sunny open field. We followed the tracks until they simply ended. The only other mark was a kind of swoosh across the top of the perfect snow where the tracks stopped. We could only imagine that it was the lighting of the wing of the bird who came and took the mouse. A beautiful image, a once-in-a-lifetime sighting in the snow, even in its sad and harsh reality. And listeners, I'd love to know if you have a tracking experience like that that you'd like to share with us, or a question for Lynn or Rose about tracking, how to do it, how to identify the tracks that you're seeing, and maybe where to go. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or go to Facebook and post your photos for us. And I once saw a mark like that in the snow of two big wings that had just sort of landed in the snow, and you could see this imprint of wings and a few tufts of little fur around. And Lynn, it is a remarkable sight when you see that, because it's just so easy to picture that scene.
And that's what it's all about. It's becoming that animal that you're tracking. So I had this wonderful story this morning that a friend of mine called up that had been on a tracking workshop. And she watched with me, she watched two tracks, and they were fox tracks, coming out, separating. First it looked like there's just one, and then it became two, and then it became one. And what was exciting was that she felt like she was that animal. And in turns, it turned out the story was that they were mating.
Huh. So how do you know that they're mating? I mean, how do you know that they're not just like going for a walk in the snow together, or tracking something of their own?
Right. Well, they're solitary animals, so the only time they're together is when they're mating.
Huh.
So it's in January that's happening, so look out. It's going to be here soon.
So, Lynn, snow is ideal for this kind of tracking and seeing things, whether you're a novice or an experienced tracker, because it does create this fresh blanket and the tracks are really visible. Can you talk a little bit about what we're likely to see at this time of year?
Well, one thing you should know is that right after it snows, it's a blanket and you won't see anything. It's like the teacher that went up to the board and wiped it out. And then it starts again, the story. And so the stories just appear, like the one I saw yesterday of where deer just rustled up and looking for acorns, and they just, you look for acres, they were there. So you could see deer in deer beds this time of year, which is where the conifers are, so that the wind and the snow is less. So that's another. Looking at the wetlands that you were talking about would be fabulous. And because Vermont is so wonderful that you can walk anywhere, it's 80% privately owned. But unless there's a no trespassing sign, you're able to go on that land and check out, follow your track, follow the tracks. Because that's what's most important, is to follow the tracks.
Now, some things you won't see, of course, and like amphibians and hibernators, animals that are not out on the snow. But, Rose, beyond the footprints themselves, given that you're seeing some things and not seeing others, what is this winter landscape with all of these crisscrossing tracks and identities tell us about who's out and about and what's actually happening on the landscape at this time of year?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jane. It helps us really, as Lynn said, think like the animal and put ourselves in their paws. So are they looking for food? Do you see signs of berries or yellow birch seeds or maybe some drops of blood? You know, what have they been doing to forage and make their living? And where have they been finding shelter? Like Lynn mentioned, the deer under the conifers. Something I love to find, and it often happens when I'm out skiing or snowshoeing, is a kind of depression in the ground, not very big, and there'll be just a little bit of scat in it. And I'll just say scat is another word for poop. So there's this very distinctive poop and maybe some wing brushes, and that's it. And the scat tells me that it's a ruffed grouse or partridge, and they will take shelter down in the snow when it's very cold. They'll spend the whole evening letting the snow be their insulating blanket. And in the morning, they pop out. And I've actually, when I get out early enough, I've actually spooked up rough grouse out of their snow hole a few times. It scares me and it scares them.
Yeah, it is startling because you can get pretty close and then all of a sudden they sort of puff up and fly. And it's a little bit alarming. I love seeing the corridors where, you know, sometimes you can see it when there's no snow because the ground will be packed down. Or you guys mentioned seeing otter slides and fisher slides. I love seeing where beavers have been going up and about and you can see this sort of corridor. But in the snow, it's really apparent where animals are tracking. You can kind of see these highways and byways where there are lots of different kinds of tracks. And you know, this is just a place that animals walk, and often they're along the same paths that humans walk, because it would make sense to me to think, if I were an animal, why not go on a track that's already kind of packed down and where the trees have been removed? I mean, it seems, Lynn, like it makes sense for animals to go on the path of least resistance and let the humans do the work.
Absolutely. I've seen that over and over again. On snowmobile trails, you'll see the tracks of animals, too. And some of the special, you were just talking back and forth, like porcupines. They go back and forth over their own trail, and they can find it right to the ledge where they're living temporarily, and then it goes to another little cave where they're living. So you can just watch them go back and forth, and that's really fun.
We got a note from Anne who says, when we first moved to Woodstock 2 years ago from Baltimore, after the first snow, I was amazed, and I still am. Our backyard looks as if a big animal rave has taken place. I love it. And Rose, that's pretty cool, too, because often you don't see the animals that are around you because, you know, they hide or they come out at night when we're not outside. And in the morning, you go out and you see these tracks and you have a sense of this activity that's happening right under your nose that you don't even know about during the summertime or, you know, when you're going about your normal life. That's very cool.
It's so true, Jane. I can think of some hemlock woods behind my house. And if I go out there in the winter, first of all, I don't want to push the deer around, but it is a deer yard. And I see their tracks crisscrossing everywhere. I can see these depressions in the ground where they've spent the night. And occasionally you can find a deer carcass. Sad thing to see, but that's nature. And you can see all kinds of predator tracks around that carcass, taking advantage of that easy food and, you know, coyote tracks and other things, too, that will scavenge. So that's one of those rave situations where, yep, you're seeing the gathering, and it comes alive to you. Wow, this was a big happening here. A lot of animals were here.
I once had the opportunity to find some bobcat tracks and follow them along. They were bounding, moving really quickly, and they went from deer bed to deer bed. And so they weren't successful. I didn't find any blood, but I did follow their path as they might have been another hour or so later find something.
In a couple of minutes, we're going to talk a little bit about how you can actually figure out what you're looking at, how you ID tracks, how you have a sense of what the behavior is that is reflected in those tracks. And listeners, if you have questions about that, or if you'd just like to share your experiences with animal prints in the snow and some tracking you may have been doing, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Richard is calling in from Wells River. Hi, Richard. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't have a tracking question, but it is an animal question. For years, I've put Christmas lights on a fence at the end of my driveway near a lamppost. And for years, I used the old 9C light, you know. And a few years ago, I went to LEDs. And those bulbs are rough, you know, they have a little texture to them. And I used them a couple of years, and then last year I put them out, and then the next night when I went out to plug them in, the lights didn't work. And so I started, you know, to investigate, and I found that lots and lots of the bulbs had been chewed off by the two wires that lights them up, and the bulbs were gone.
And do you have a hunch, Richard?
Well, when your guest was talking about the red squirrels and the apples, and that's what somebody else had thought, and so I just thought I'd call and ask.
Richard, thanks for the call. It's the mystery of the stolen Christmas lights. Lynn, do you have any ideas?
You know what I have is that it's great that you asked the question. I can't narrow it down for you too much, but the fact that you asked what it is and keep on exploring it. Clearly, it's good to know exactly kind of the woods that are around you or the woods around you.
Richard, so tell us a little bit about the landscape.
And there's a big hay field out front. Mm-hmm. It's mostly pine.
Mostly pine. Well, and it's common for red squirrels to be living in conifers. That's their regular habitat. So could be. I don't know. One of the things
I'm
saying.
And, you know, there are several strings tied in together.
Oh, my gosh.
And the farther they went from the lamppost, the less bulbs were gone, but they did manage to chew some on every string, so none of them worked.
Oh, how wonderful are you for you, Richard. Thanks for the call. I appreciate that. I mean, Lynn, we can surmise, though, that it's certainly not some things. It wouldn't likely be a deer, right? It's more likely to be some rodent that can climb up and crawl around.
That's right. You've sort of narrowed it down. And so instead of saying, I don't know at all, you've just brought it down to some possibilities. So you're right. The beaver is not going to be up there doing that.
The beaver would be more likely to try to go for the lamppost, not the Christmas lights.
That is such a great image, seeing that lamppost being...
Now, that I would like to see. Let's go to Spencer, who's calling in from Colchester. Hi, Spencer. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Well, thanks for having me on the air. I have a short story about a now-deceased dog. She was an Akita named Mantra. And we were in the woods in Williston, and she pointed in the snow at a blank spot of snow. And she wouldn't let me move. She had me by the leash and was trying to drag me towards this blank spot of snow. And as I looked over, to the left of that spot, there were bird marks in the snow where it looked like a bird had either taken off or landed. And as I gave her some slack, she had far better instincts than I did. There was a ground bird hiding under the snow, sleeping. And she spooked it, not in the spot where the wings are, but in the spot where she was pointing, about 5 yards away.
Wow, Spencer, that's
so I was wondering, have you ever heard of, you know, a ground bird leaving like a decoy track near where they were sleeping?
Huh, Rose or Lynn, have either of you heard of that?
No, I haven't heard of that, but it's fascinating that you have seen it.
Huh.
One of the things I have seen is that the animal that goes and hides underneath the snow that lives in what's called the subnivian layer, so that a shrew could be on top of the surface and boop, it's gone. Or a vole, too. So those are other stories of animals that you see. You see the tracks and they're gone.
Well, and Rose, that is one of the coolest things, or I mean, maybe not the coolest, but it is pretty neat with these rodents that, you know, you can see some of them pop up and go on top of the snow and then pop back down. And, you know, it's a little bit like birds that can swim underwater, like a loon, you know, and they pop up somewhere else to evade you, because you see these tracks that end in a little hole in the snow. And then somewhere farther along, there's this little patter patter of tracks again that you've missed, because, you know, under the snow is also this landscape that, in fact, is even more hidden to us than normal.
That is so true, Jane. It's a great description of what you can find in almost any field. And the Nature Conservancy staff were out having their holiday outing on Tuesday, and we were out at the Otter Creek Swamps in Cornwall, and we saw exactly that thing, little tunnels in the snow, little holes that would pop up. And as we trudged along, having our nice day, a little head kept popping up at people. People in the line would notice it, and they thought it was a meadow vole, which is a kind of a root-eating rodent, an herbivore, that lives out in open fields like that. So I think we were in its neighborhood, and it was saying, what on earth? We must have sounded like a herd of elephants going by. It had to check us out.
There's a fabulous children's story called Under the Snow. It's a picture book, And it shows all of those images for kids. It's fabulous.
Well, I hope listeners were getting you jazzed about tracking and giving you some great ideas of images and things that you can see. The Lake Champlain Waldorf School sounds inspired. They posted this morning on our Facebook page to say, "The snow is falling here in Shelburne, giving us a window into the life of our fellow residents in the forests and fields that make up the 22 acres of the Turtle Lane campus. Let's see who lives here." And coming up on the program, we're going to talk a little bit more about how you actually do the tracking, some do's and don'ts, and you know what? How do you understand the IDs? How do you know if a footprint is a coyote or your dog? And how do you know what you're looking at and what that behavior might be? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. Or post a photo for us if you'd like on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We are learning about how to track winter wildlife today with author, forester, and environmental educator Lynn Levine, and with Rose Paul, the Director of Critical Lands and Conservation Science for the Nature Conservancy in Vermont. And we're hearing from many of you who are posting photos on our Facebook page of tracks you've seen. You can share a memory there or ask a question or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Ken is the refuge manager at the Missisquoi National Refuge, and he emailed to say, "A great place to see wildlife tracks is the Missisquoi Refuge in Swanton. There are 7 miles of public use trails for walking, snowshoeing, or cross-country skiing. You can see otter slides and tracks along the Missisquoi River, fisher and deer and turkey in the woods, and much, much more." We got a note from Nelson who says, "A few years ago, I was tracking a bobcat in the snow. It went up to a pile of rocks and a small cave. I could see some porcupine quills and evidence where the cat's curiosity got the best of her. The cat's tracks told the story. It ran away, peeing as it exited the scene."
I love that.
And Eric in Castleton says, "I've seen a fisher across the road down here in Castleton. In the snow, I've been able to track deer and cats. I'm unfamiliar with one that seems to be grouped into 3 paw prints in a cluster about 8 inches in diameter, and then a stretch of maybe 3 feet, and another cluster of 3. Any ideas, Lynn?"
Well, I'm wondering, how big were those tracks? Any idea in comparison to a shoe, let's say?
I have no idea. So he says 3 paw prints in a cluster about 8 inches in diameter.
8 inches in diameter, the cluster itself.
I'm assuming the cluster, because an 8-inch paw print in diameter would be a really big cat.
Yeah, really would be. It could possibly be any animal that typically walks, okay, and when they're moving faster, then they can shout out to that 3 paws and 3 paws, and that's typical of a fisher.
Huh.
So it's often 2 by 2 by 2, and then it's 3. So it's a combination. So it could be possibly be a fisher, or it could be a red fox, perhaps.
Well, you know, this gets us into a good place about how the heck do you find out, you know, what you're looking at, because you can see these prints, but to really be able to imagine the scene in your mind, you need to kind of know what the animals are, or often that helps. So, Rose, do you have tips for how to figure out what you're looking at?
Well, there's certainly some basic things, some basic questions that you have to go through in your mind, Jane. How wide are the paws apart? And how long from one set of prints to the next? And perhaps I should have started with, what's the overall pattern? Are prints 2 by 2, back feet and front feet next to each other? Or do you get lines of kind of 4 footfalls and then another set of 4 footfalls. All those patterns and those measurements can help you narrow it down to which family. Is it in the cat family, the dog family, or the weasel family, the rabbits? And from there you go into your measurements, and there are some wonderful guides. And I'm going to give a shout out to Lynn Levine, who has a wonderful Mammal Tracks and Scat Guide.
It's even waterproof.
And it's waterproof. There's life-size tracks and lots of information, but I think it's a beautiful thing to take out, especially with kids, And you can, it leads you very nicely through helping you figure out those basic questions and then some great pictures and measurements. And, you know, I think anybody can be a wildlife tracker when you have a tool like this.
So, Lynn, this is your book that yes. Rose is giving a great shout out to, and it is
thanks,
you have
Rose.
A bigger one and a smaller one, so you can put mm-hmm. it in your back pocket and take it out and look at the tracks. And do you have advice for people, whether they have your book or not, for how to sort of get started understanding those footprint IDs?
Well, first, the first step is habitat again. Where am I? Am I in the meadow or not, or am I in the middle of the woods? And then you can think about whether the tracks are the same size, all of them, or do they have a big one and a little foot? And that spreads out. So the ones that are the same size are in the weasel family, in the dog family, the cat family. Those are the ones that have the same size feet. And then there's all those that have different back. The hind feet is usually larger, about, you know, and then the front one. And so those fill in the other animals. So it's a good way to think about what is the size of the print. Are they the same or not? And then, you know, just like what Rose was saying, looking at the pattern is so important. So when you just stop and look at one track and you just say, what is that? Not good. You need to follow it out. And if you follow it out, then you'll get lots more information.
So one of the things that we found out one of the last times we did a show about tracking was that you still do need to be careful and be conscious of the animals around you and what you might be disturbing, but also that if you're tracking something that's on the move, you might be making it move. You might be pushing that animal, and you don't want to stress animals out, especially ones that might be vulnerable to getting more tired, like deer in deep snow. So, Rose, how do you know? I mean, one of the things we've heard in the past is track backwards, so you're not actually forcing the animal forwards, but you're sort of tracing it back to its start.
I think that's a really smart way to approach it, Jane. And you can look at how fresh the tracks appear to be. You know, sometimes you can just tell the edges are a little melted out, and you're looking at tracks from a few days ago. Those are probably safe to follow forward.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of a time when I was guilty of this, Jane. We were just tootling along, following a set of tracks, and pausing and kind of looking around. We were ambling ourselves. And when I looked up, I saw an animal in the tree. And it was actually a fisher in broad daylight, which is
wow.
Such a rare thing to come across. And as we stood there gawking at it, being insensitive probably, it started chittering at us almost the way a red squirrel would. Its tail was, you know, twitching, and it was making these little noises. We were annoying it, and we thought, let's get out of here. This isn't a nice thing to be doing.
Well, that's a great story. And to get back to your question, Jane, too, the front and the back of the track really look different. So if you can at all see the nails or the toes, whoop, go the other direction if it's a fresh track.
Yeah, because that'll tell you that it's really fresh if you can
right.
actually see that imprint.
Right, and if it's going deep, the deep part is the front part, so you can follow it the other way. I'm mostly worried about, and the advice is not following bobcats, because if you follow them, they might be sitting still hunting. So it's much better to go the other directions, especially for that species.
Because you're actually stressing it out while it's trying to be still and hunt?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Rather than most of the time, there's no way near that you're going to actually find these animals. They smell you. They're way out of the way. But bobcat is one that might just be sitting still hunting.
Hmm. We got a note from Sally, who posted a response to our caller, Richard, who had his Christmas lights nod off. And Sally says, it probably was a red squirrel. I watched in dismay a few weeks ago as a red squirrel delicately chewed one light after another off my string of solar LEDs. I've seen it happen twice before at my house, always it is the red squirrels. Sally, thanks for that. I hope, Richard, at least you have some solace in knowing perhaps what animal it was, if not having your beautiful Christmas lights. And Eric in Castleton, who wrote in about the 8-inch diameter cluster, says, yeah, it was three prints within that 8-inch circle, and each print was only about an inch and a half or so. So let's go to Catherine, who's calling in from Westminster Station. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead.
Hello. This is not a winter or track-related thing, but it's a mystery. A few years ago, I was on my land in Piermont, New Hampshire. This would be summer or spring. And I passed by this bush. I would say it's probably a honeysuckle. And it had some bare twigs, you know. And there was a mouse impaled on one of those twigs.
Oh.
Dead naturally. And this has been a mystery to me ever since. What could have done such a thing?
Boy, Rose or Lynn, do you have any idea what could impale a mouse?
Yeah, that's a really cool sighting that I'm always looking for. It was probably a northern shrike, which is a bird that's around in winter, and it's not in the hawk family, but it can act a little bit hawk-like, and it will take small animals, and if it isn't ready to eat a kill right away, it will impale it on a thorn in something like a hawthorn bush, and it's storing its food for later.
Wow, that's pretty cool. What a cool sighting, Catherine. Thank you for that. Let's go to Gordon in Waterbury. Hi, Gordon. Go ahead.
Hey, Jane. Big Jane fan.
And oh, thank you.
You are the cherry groves of Vermont. But I just wanted to let callers know about Little River State Park in Waterbury. It's an awesome place to go down, and I've been seeing some buffleheads and wood ducks and cool stuff down there, and just wanted to let more people know about it.
Gordon, thanks. Yeah, that is a really cool place, Little River State Park. Awesome. Thank you for that. Let's go to Reba in Mendon. Hi, Reba.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a little story, a fox story. We keep a bird feeder a few feet behind our house. And one evening, I happened to open the back door and turn the back light on. And a fox had been there. He backed off. He or she backed off, but stayed right there within sight. And so I said, oh, good evening, Mr. Fox. How are you this evening? At which point he just went back over to our bird feeder and continued to eat. And we enjoyed our encounter. Thank you.
Reba, thanks for that. And Kent is calling in from Stowe. Hi, Kent. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. I'm a big fan, too. And this is a great show. This is really a, you know, good feel-good thing to get people outside in winter and have an appreciation for wildlife. But I think it is worthwhile reminding everyone that we are in the midst of trapping season. Trapping is allowed on all public lands in Vermont, and State of Vermont Fish and Wildlife actively promotes trapping, and this is primarily leg hold traps that are targeting both bobcat and otter and other species. So it's really worthwhile to be paying attention if you're out with your dogs in particular. I think a certain amount of caution is warranted, and you can go on the Protect Our Wildlife website and learn how to remove an animal from a leg hold trap if one of your pets was to be so unfortunate to encounter one.
Kent, yeah, thanks for that. Appreciate it. It is always really a good idea to pay attention to where you are, and those traps can be hard to spot sometimes. Peter in Underhill says, I look for areas in my woods where there are lots of tracks in the snow as a clue to where I should put up my wildlife camera. The photos give me more evidence of what's happening and when the animals were there. It also helps me identify any tracks that I may not recognize. And Mark says, last winter I was working in the woods and I noticed little tufts of loose grass on top of cut stumps from a lodging project from a few years ago. I noticed this over a period of several days until I finally spotted a few drops of blood alongside these little piles of loose grass. I finally decided they must have been from some type of raptor swooping down, grabbing its prey, and then eating it on the top of a stump like a dinner plate. Lynn and Rose, before we let you go, just quickly, do you have favorite spots or favorite types of places that you would suggest to people who are now excited to go out and do some snow tracking?
I would say that find that special wetland or that corridor where the animals are moving. So on TNC land, where that I go, the rock formation is coming straight down, and that's where the animals have to move back and forth. And so it's a great place to see those tracks.
Jane, I'd love to give a shout-out to the Nature Conservancy's 55 natural areas. They're in every county of Vermont. And you can find out about them at nature.org/Vermont. And I also want to bring people's attention to our state wildlife management areas because we have over 133,000 acres. It's very easy to go on the Department of Fish and Wildlife's website and get information about those. There are many of them in every county.
Well, those are great suggestions, and listeners, I want to thank you for your suggestions and for the photos you're posting to our Facebook page. We'll see if we can compile them maybe and put them all in one place, but if not, you can scroll through. Rose Paul is the Director of Critical Lands and Conservation Science for the Nature Conservancy in Vermont, and Lynn Levine is an author, forester, and environmental educator. You can pick up her book of Scat and Tracks. Lynn and Rose, thank you both very much. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been so much fun.
This was a lot of fun, Jane.
Coming up, we'll look at whether racial profiling is at play in how immigration policies are put in practice in Vermont. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There are about 400,000 immigrants without legal status living and working in New England. This week, VPR and the New England News Collaborative have been looking at federal policy and personal experiences of some of the immigrants living in the Northeast. VPR's Kathleen Masterson focused on Vermont dairy workers who were tracked and arrested by immigration officials. Kathleen joins us now to talk a little bit about what she found. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jane.
So when it comes to deportations, federal law is actually pretty explicit about who and who should not be a priority. Can you detail it for us?
Yeah, that's right. Federal guidelines that were issued in 2014, so that's later in the Obama administration, made it clear that immigration officials were really supposed to be targeting criminals. And they outlined priorities, the highest level being people involved in terrorism, espionage, gang activity, and aggravated felonies. And then some of the people that we see happening more in New England are also DUI, domestic violence, drug addiction. So they made it very clear that federal officials are supposed to be targeting those criminals. And just by the way, that's in response to the program that preceded it that was widely unpopular. And
this was Secure Communities?
Exactly. Secure Communities that was it is embroiled in some litigation. Many mayors refused to implement it because it basically started the policy where they set up local law enforcement with anytime you fingerprint someone, those fingerprints go into a database run by the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, that's also shared with ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So it resulted in a lot of people getting picked up who were, you know, otherwise law-abiding citizens, tax-paying citizens, split-up families. So there was a real backlash against that program, and that's why we're seeing even more detailed guidelines to really focus on criminals.
If somebody is fingerprinted, though, they are still put into that database that ICE can access, right? That was not changed.
Exactly. That technology was set up under Secure Communities, and it is staying and ongoing. So those fingerprints, anytime anyone is booked, no matter what your citizenship status is, that's going into the FBI.
But basically, the federal government said, look, our priority is criminals. So we want you to arrest people, or we're focused on the deportation of people who are here without papers, who are involved in felonies or other serious crimes. What about Vermont state law? What does that say?
Right. Well, certainly Vermont state law abides by those federal guidelines and also goes beyond that, actually. We have fair and impartial policing policy on the books that makes it very clear that local law enforcement is not supposed to be acting as an immigration official. That's clear federally, and then we've also made that extra clear in the state. And that's in part because there's concern that racial profiling could be involved. If someone doesn't speak perfect English and law enforcement were to tip off ICE, that's not legal. That's a racial profiling. That does not indicate what that person's status is. And and local law enforcement aren't trained, frankly, to be immigration officials. So Vermont has several state laws in the books that are really designed to prevent that kind of thing from happening.
Nonetheless, you found in your reporting that these guidelines and laws are not always being applied as they're supposed to be according to statute. Can you give us an example?
Yeah. One example that happened last year was a man named Lorenzo Alcudia. He was actually just a passenger in a car on Grand Isle. The driver was pulled over for speeding. Actually, the driver did not get a ticket. But then the car was illegally detained simply because the passenger was perceived to be of Mexican origin. And Border Patrol was called. He didn't have a criminal background, but he was still picked up and put into deportation proceedings. So he's still awaiting that hearing. He did win a judgment from the Vermont's Human Rights Commission that this was a discriminatory stop, but it doesn't change federal law that he's already now in proceedings.
And so was this illegal according to Vermont's law and according to Vermont's guidelines on fair and impartial policing?
Yeah, and it didn't go through a court, just to be clear. Mm-hmm. It did get determined by that Human Rights Justice Commission. So, yeah, that would be a form of illegal discrimination.
But he is still involved in proceedings for deportation. And you also found another example.
Yeah, actually, Miguel Alcudia is his cousin. They both work on dairy farms. And he was picked up on the charges of having an expired visa. So again, you know, he is in the country illegally, but he's not supposed to be a priority for deportation. So it's unclear how immigration officials heard about him. He did relay that they said to him when they picked him up that they had been called about him, which also brings up some questions about, you know, what reporting is happening that shouldn't be happening. But again, he's also in deportation proceedings, even though that's not a high priority under the Obama guidelines for deportation.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up this idea that it's not just law enforcement that we're talking about. It's not just when somebody interacts with a police officer where there might be this question of what's the police officer's role? What's the federal law say? I mean, in that example you just gave, somebody tipped off ICE. But you're saying that, you know, he shouldn't be a priority under the federal guidelines for deportation, but they're still allowed to initiate deportation proceedings against somebody without papers, whether or not it's a priority, right?
That's exactly right. They really are. You know, if you read the memo, as I have, there's the Department of Homeland Security is requesting that the ICE officers exhibit their discretion starting from the very beginning, when you, even before you stop someone, question them, is this person a high priority? And in part, that's resource driven. You know, we don't want to be spending our taxpayer dollar resources on deporting people who aren't the highest priority. So the memo does look for that. But sure, certainly, anyone who's here illegally could still be deported. We're also seeing, I have some numbers on Massachusetts court, which is the immigration court for all of New England, in large part. And we're seeing that deportations percent of people who are going through that court is actually going down. It's a little unclear, is that judge's discretion? Is that because we're seeing these people picked up who aren't high priorities and they're getting to stay? That's not clear. But it is clear that the percentage of people being deported that are being seen by courts is going down, which is interesting.
So what do you think the upshot of your reporting is here, Kathleen, on the idea of deportations and whether in New England and in particular in Vermont, we are seeing people who are being deported who are not high priorities, at least according to what the federal government says should be high priority?
It's really hard to get data, and that was one of the most challenging parts here. I did pull some data on detainers because I think, to answer your question, that, you know, we are still seeing cases of people that are not high priority being picked up. And some of these cases, some of the workers are activists. It's unclear if that has anything to do with it at all. It may not, but just to be clear, some people are leaders in migrant justice.
So they'd be visible.
Right, exactly, more visible. And an interesting, and just to clarify, we don't have data on who's being arrested, so I unfortunately can't give you that by state, but a detainer is when immigration officials say, hey, law enforcement, can you hold on to this person? And there's some background there about how they've changed that language to be more legal. But basically what we saw from 2015, so again, this is after those changes that we're supposed to be focusing on criminals, 70% of the detainers issues in Vermont were for people who had no criminal record. So, and we're seeing that same number in Rhode Island. Massachusetts was a little bit lower at 30%. So we're still seeing detainers issued for people who are non-criminals, which suggests that there are still people with no criminal record that are being picked up.
What did the people you interviewed say about how they feel about the legal risks they face?
Yeah, I heard a whole range of opinions, but a really common theme was certainly a feeling of fear, really. And people use the word encerrado, which sort of means enclosed. closed, a feeling that they had to stay on the farm, couldn't drive, didn't want to be seen publicly because there's a fear that even just being driving around, someone could be picked up or reported. One person I spoke with even sold his car. He'd bought a car with a friend, said, I don't feel safe driving. I'm just going to stay on the farm. Other people have said, you know, if I get deported, I get deported. I'm here to work, to fight for my rights. So there's really a full range.
That's VPR's Kathleen Masterson, who has been reporting as part of a series we've been airing from the New England News Collaborative that looks at the challenges and the opportunities facing New England when it comes to immigration. This series is called Facing Change, and you can find all of it at vpr.net. Thanks very much for talking to us about it, Kathleen.
Thanks, Jane.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, with hacks all across the headlines, we'll be talking about cybersecurity. From keeping your own information safe to how well protected the state's institutions and infrastructure are against cyber attack. Send your questions and comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Elder Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.